What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, their families, communities, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me on the phone from L.A. is Richard Greenberg. Richard is the author of Raising Children That Other People Like to Be Around. Richard provides five common sense musts from a father's point of view. Richard, welcome to 411 Team.
Well, thanks for having me on, Dr. Liz.
Yeah. What was your impetus for writing the book?
Well, you know, people would always say that they don't give you an owner's manual when you have a child. Mm-hmm. And I felt that people wanted or needed guidance in general. And there was really nothing that I had seen that was plain English written by a normal dad that could help people sort of understand the strengths that we have ourselves to be parents without having to go into any scientific study about it. And I sort of concluded that it was common sense. Now, that comes to me from my wife, because we would be out at a restaurant and I would say, how can those people let that child behave that way? And she would say to me, I don't think they know what to do. I just think they're paralyzed. They don't know what to do. So I decided I would write a book that would help people sort of find the strength inside themselves and the knowledge inside themselves to be able to apply their own wisdom and their own common sense to the way in which they were raising their children. Because in the end, what we've learned in the way we raised our children, which has been fairly strict, but loving, is that we've raised these decent adults who communicate with us and who know how to love not only us, but each other, and are very well received in the world. And so it ultimately came down to, you know, what is the goal of raising children? And that goal for us was to raise children that other people wanted to be around, that to raise children that were considered friendly and respectful and kind. And, you know, not ironically, those are the same values that we tried to instill in them when we set about the path of raising them up.
Mm-hmm. When you think about parenting today in 2015, do you find it, what do you think? Do you think it's more challenging than it was in 2000 or 1980? What's your take on that when you just think about the parenting process?
I think it's more complicated. Mm-hmm. I think that there have been a lot of people who have expressed opinions about whether there's a right way to do it and a wrong way. There used to pretty much be one right way to do it, and the right way was to teach your child to be obedient and have them sit down and be quiet. You know, children are meant to be seen and not heard.
Right.
You know, spare the rod, spoil the child. There were a lot of axioms that went with the older styles of parenting. And I think that that simplified the process, to say nothing of, you know, cell phones and tablets and computers and instant messaging and, you know, live video and everything available on the internet. So, you know, I think that parenting has gotten much more complicated in that way. But I also think that if you boil it down to the very basics, it's the same job as it always was. And that same job is to teach your child that they live in the world with other people, and that respecting other people and not believing that you deserve everything in the world and being kind and being honest, those are the things that I think ultimately end up defining your child as a good citizen. You know, gratitude. So it doesn't matter whether it's 1980 or 2015. Mm-hmm. You need to raise a grateful child. You need to raise an honest child. And in all that, there's all those distractions that come from everything else. But part of what my book is about is really sort of narrowing down that very first thing that you want to do is set an example as a parent. Because, you know, in my own study of myself and you know, looking back on how I was raised and then looking at how I raised my children, I see what parts of me are sort of the residue of the way I was parented. Mm-hmm. And each of us has that residue in us, and some of the things our parents did were wrong, and some of the things our parents did were right, but we can choose now, in the way we raise our children, to implement the right things and learn from the wrong things and try and avoid them. So again, over the generations, I think that each one of us, each subsequent generation, has an opportunity to improve on the generation before, and we just get thrown curveballs that are new technologies, changes in society, things that can throw off sort of your main objectives. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is those main objectives do remain the same: honesty, gratitude, kindness, and respect.
Your book is structured around five simple principles for which you created, I guess, an anagram, SMART. Talk about this. I like that concept. I thought it was clever. It went real well. And I read the book, and I thought it was very informative. But talk about SMART.
Well, thank you. So I took the word SMART and used it as an anagram. Mm-hmm. And I chose SMART because I wanted a word that would fit on five fingers. I can't remember anything past five fingers. You know, I can't even go to a sixth finger. So my five-finger solution was S-M-A-R-T, and that stood for set an example, make the rules, apply those rules, respect yourself, and teach in everything that you do. And if you understand that you are teaching in everything that you do, then, you know, setting an example becomes a pretty natural thing to do. But it also means that you put the cart back at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. It means that you say please and thank you to people. You get off your phone when you're checking out at the market. You have an actual discussion with the person who's helping you. You look them in the eye. And those things that we can do as parents ultimately model for our children how I believe that they grow up. My kids, you know, picked up habits of mine that I was never intent on teaching them to do. So they picked up good habits and bad habits. I heard a little speech thing that I used to do, and my kids would start doing it. I go, what is that? Where did that come from? And they would say, well, Dad, you do that all the time. I do.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, setting an example is really important. And then part of it goes back to what I was just talking about, which is a thing called the ghosts in our nursery.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have ghosts in our nursery, which is how we were raised. And we have to look at those, and we have to decide with whomever we're raising our children, which one of these things do we want to repeat? How do we want to do what our parents did that was right? And how do we want to do what our parents did that, or how do we want to avoid what
mm-hmm.
our parents did that was wrong? And, you know, that's it's a very interesting exercise. My book has a questionnaire in it that parents should ask each other about what their goals are and how they see their child and what their values are. So that once you've established those values in the set an example portion, you can move into the making the rules portion, because those rules mm-hmm. are really defined by your values.
Right.
Don't lie.
I know you focus on setting an example, which can be very difficult, because I think of that adage, you know, do as I say, not as I do. And so that was a way that the parent would avoid having to set that example. So whenever you say that, I think of that, because, you know, they'd be like,
You know, that one falls into the same category.
Mm-hmm,
boys
mm-hmm.
will be boys.
Right,
so like,
right.
No, they need to behave properly.
Right,
and
exactly.
And do as I say, not as I do is a classic, because it allows people to make an excuse
right.
for doing dumb stuff.
Exactly.
And ultimately, this is a job about responsibility. When you become a parent, you have to put aside all those little things you want to do yourself.
Because you are a model.
You're going to do what needs to be done so that your child grows up with some sense of
right.
how the world works.
How important is it, Richard, for parents, when there's a two-parent home, for both parents to be on the same page?
Well, I think it's really important, because I think what happens is your children learn how to use you against each other
uh-huh.
and to work the deal so that they get what they want. So, you know, we had not always pre-discussed every issue that came up, but if somebody came to me and said, Dad, can I go to the movie with my friend Billy today? I would say, let me talk to your mom about it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's okay. And then we would go find his mom, and his mom would say yes or no, or, you know, agree with me. And there were certain things that were no problem. But, you know, teamwork, you know, it's really about
that's
the way
what
you
it is.
Your team.
That's what it is. Yeah, because you'll find that the children will manipulate, because they might come to you and ask you if they could go to the movie, when some of them may have already asked mom and mom has said no. But
exactly.
then they'll go back and say, well, I talked to Dad And he said it was okay. So if he said it was okay, then why not? You know, that little manipulation there.
Totally. And that's the funny thing about it is, and this is something I think is really important, once they know you operate as a team, they no longer try those shenanigans.
Right.
They know, you know, they know that if you say something, it's going to be backed up by your mate, you know, by the other parent. And so in doing that, you know, and that's true of most of this parenting practice that I'm talking about. When you establish early what your expectations are of your children, then they pick them up early. And so you don't end up with a kid who's 9 years old who isn't used to being told no. You know, you don't end up with a kid who is speaking disrespectfully to you because you've already quashed that one when they were 3 or 4 years old and said, this is not okay in this family. This isn't how we communicate.
Right.
And by the way, operating as a team as parents teaches your children how to collaborate with other people as well and teaches them that, you know, they don't have to make rogue decisions. They can operate respectfully with another person. And so, again, you're setting and modeling an example of how people communicate with each other. And that part of it's very interesting. And then what happens is they get older is you begin to get a little bit of feedback about, okay, look, I know mom's going to be tough for this. So this is what I've got. You know, they come in with a strategy
right. For
how they're going to help convince the other parent to get this done. Will that work for you? You know, now they're negotiating.
Mm-hmm.
It's like yes or no answer. So it's pretty fun as they evolve. But the bottom line is I believe we're managing a team. My wife and I are managing a team, and the kids are our players. And we need to know what their strengths are. We need to know what their weaknesses are. And we need to manage them so that they can be successful and win their games. And that's really kind of how it works out.
But I think you said a couple key words. The operative thing, one, was that you were a team. And that's really important that you approach it in that manner, that you have to be a team. You have to be on the same page. So I think that that's important. You also talked about communication, and we're going to get back into that. We're going to take a brief break. But when we come back, I wanted to ask you to, you have a little formula in the book. And that formula was the 5-5-20 formula. I like that formula and wanted to have you share that with my listening audience. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with Richard Greenberg, parent and author. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and their families and their communities and all other interested folks. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with Richard Greenberg, who is out in L.A., and he is a parent and an author. He has written a book, Raising Children That Other People Like to Be Around. Richard, right before we went on break, I was asking you to share that formula of 5-5-20, please.
Absolutely. So 5-5-20 works like this. When a hard decision needs to be made and you've got to say no to your child, basically for 5 minutes they're going to be angry at you.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 5 days they're going to forget the whole thing happened. And then in 20 years they're going to come back and thank you for having done that tough thing for them. And I've seen it happen. You know, I've seen lessons that we taught our children come back and have our kids say, you know, I'm so glad you taught us how to sit at the table and be polite and shake people's hands, because now I do that. The people are always like, wow, you really have a good handshake and you really look me in the eye when you shook my hand. And I think that those kinds of things, even though kids go like, oh, God, that's not important, who cares? Ultimately, what we know what matters, we're the adults in the relationship with our children. And because we know what matters, it's important for us to try and impart that to our children, even if they don't appear to be listening or they don't seem to care. It's very important because, again, they're going to be angry at you for 5 minutes. They won't remember it in 5 days because something will have happened and their boyfriend or girlfriend would have said something and they'd all be off in a tizzy. And then in 20 years, when either they're having their own kids or they've gone away to college, and they've met other kids whose parents were ridiculous, they usually come back and say, wow, thank you so much for, you know, being strict about this and strict about that. Some of these kids are such jerks at college. So we get a lot of positive feedback about that.
Well, I know your chapter 3 addressed after you set an example and you make the rules, then you have to apply the rules. What are the important or significant tenets of this application, of applying these rules that you would identify with us?
Well, I think when you apply the rules, you just have to remember why you made them in the first place. And what I spent my time on in that chapter was empowering parents to believe that they have the right to apply the rules, that it's important that your children learn. So, you know, we have to apply them early in our kids' lives because it's not only easier, but it's a safer starting point when it comes to the children testing their rules than it is when they're older and things are more amplified. And I think that we also have to be pretty reasonable about the rules that we create for our children and understand, and this is really important, understand that over time, sometimes things change. Sometimes a rule you made can then be reduced. Like, you know, when I was a little kid, my mom said, you can ride your bike 2 blocks. You're allowed to ride anywhere within this 2-block area. And so that's how I rode my bike for a while. And then at some point, she said, you know, you seem to be more responsible. You can go 4 blocks. So now you can ride my bike to a house of a friend who lives 4 blocks away. And so those rules, you know, you have to remain on top of what's going on. And you have to be able to say to your child, I really appreciate that you've been following these rules, and as a result, I'm going to loosen them up, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we as parents have to make some sacrifices when we have set a rule or we say, you know, you're not going to have a tantrum in the restaurant. If you have a tantrum in the restaurant, we're going to take you out of the restaurant. If you make that threat and then you don't take them out of the restaurant, you keep tantruming, that's an idle threat and you don't have any credibility. And children are very, very, very smart. You said it earlier. You know, they figure out how to work their parents and they know how to get what they want. And we as parents can't show them our weaknesses. We can't show them that they've flustered us, and we can't show them that we question the rule that we've created for them. If bedtime is bedtime, then bedtime is bedtime. We decided that was what it was going to be, and they can't have an opinion about it. And what will happen is the first few times you tell them it's bedtime, they're going to squawk about it.
Exactly, indeed.
They're going to understand that it doesn't change. This is how it works. You go to bed now. And if you lay in your bed and you do nothing, that's fine. But you're going to be in your room and in your bed. And then, you know, if you want to read, you can read. And then you begin to negotiate. But the bottom line is that you can't negotiate too early. You have to really set down what those rules are going to be. Mm-hmm. And they should be logical and fair and meaningful and not spiteful, you know, go sit in the corner, that kind of stuff.
Right.
That never, you know, that didn't work.
That doesn't accomplish anything.
Yeah, well, it accomplishes getting your kid to think
negative.
That you don't care about.
Right.
You know, like you don't understand what makes them tick. And another interesting thing that happened to me when I was a child was when a rule was applied, like if I got in trouble, most times applying rules isn't getting people in trouble. It's just meaning your room needs to be clean. That's kind of a general rule. Mm-hmm. And some days it was cleaner than others, but, you know, or your bed needs to be made. I used to really bridle at that. I did not like making my bed. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I started doing it on my own without prodding. But the bottom line was that I understood that it was something that needed to happen. And I think what happens is that, you know, if you cause rules to be blown out of proportion to the extent that when you get home you're always fighting about making your bed or whether your bed was made, then that's a problem. You know, that maybe that's not an enforceable rule, maybe that's not a logical rule. You know, what is the logic? And my parents used to always explain to me what I had done wrong when I was in trouble. You know, why you need to do this. You know, I was playing with a toy in the living room, I broke some piece of pistol, okay, what did you do wrong? And what are you going to do to avoid doing it in the future? And my parents had a thing they called an armistice, which meant that I could ask for an armistice, which meant before they discovered the broken piece of crystal in the living room, I would come up and fess up to it. So I would say, can I have an armistice? Which meant they couldn't punish me emotionally in the moment, that we were going to have to discuss it. And then granted an armistice, although they would say, maybe, but they always gave me an armistice. And I would say, I was playing with my airplane, I threw it in the living room, I broke that crystal decanter. And they would say, okay, well, so what did you do wrong? I was playing with my airplane in the living room,
mm-hmm.
right? Because is the living room a place to play with an airplane? No, it's not.
No.
Okay, so you broke the crystal decanter. Now, what are we going to do about that? And I said, well, I've cleaned it up already. Well, yes, but what kind of punishment do you think you should have? And I would always come up with something more draconian than anything.
But that's usually the case.
I would come up with, like, I'll paint the house. And they would say something to me like, no, but your dad's car needs to be washed, and you should wash your dad's car this weekend. It'll be like, you know, I was like 10 years old. It was like,
right.
Okay. But that got me off the hook. It also let me do some penance, and it also let me learn that I could tell the truth about what I had done wrong and not be threatened by something I didn't understand. It was a very honest, straightforward system, and it made for very good communication between my parents and me, because it meant they weren't just mean people. They were willing to listen, and they were willing to teach.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in for my next question, because I was just going to ask you, what role does communication play in establishing these positive relationships and parenting and rules and understanding the basis of them? You know, communication is often one of those areas that's identified when there is a breakdown or when things don't go the way we want them to go. So where does communication sit in all of this?
That's such a funny question, because even adults can't communicate with each other. So when we talk about communication and we talk about our children, I usually look at children these days to see what matters to them. As I mentioned earlier, you know, my wife and I are very communicative. We have always sort of handled things as a team. We don't keep score, you know, meaning I'll do the dishes one night, she'll do the dishes another night, she'll make dinner. We have an understanding of sort of carrying equal loads, and we don't argue about it. And I think it's really important, and it's hard for people in general, to keep their egos out of their relationships, because when you start measuring things, it gets very complicated. And it's like, well, I did the dishes three nights, and you've only done the dishes once. And you can really go down some bad spirals in your communication with people. But if you model as the parents, if you model an ability to communicate with each other, and you bring your children into it, you know, the guy who wrote my foreword, who is a doctor and a master's in public health, named Neil Halfond, very smart guy, he had seen Joanne and me, and he'd been at the house a couple of times, and he just said, you know, you guys have this energy between you that is very communicative, very open, and what happens is your children start to vibrate sympathetically at the same frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just work their way into that sort of energy loop with you. And that's kind of part of what the communication is about. It's just about being inclusive and pretending and thinking of yourselves as a team. And I know that this is all sort of, you know, West Coast touchy-feely kind of stuff, but it really comes down to making time to talk about it. We used to talk about it in the morning before I was going to work. I would be in the shower, Joanne would come into the bathroom, and we would talk about the day ahead, what was going to happen, who had a dentist appointment, who had to be where, what, you know, we would talk about what she was going to do in her day and what I was going to do in mine. And we may be hyper-communicative that way, but what was happening with our children was always on the burner with us. We also were very aware of the fact that someday our children were going to be out of our house. And when they were out of our house, we needed to retain the relationship that was our own relationship. So we would go to dinner with each other, and we made it clear to our children that we, the parents, this couple that was in charge of them, was an entity of its own that had greater value to each of us than our being parents. Meaning, our kids knew that my wife was more important to me than they were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I also have a feeling that what I believe is that people who are in a family have what I call 100% maximum love, so that there's no child who's loved more than any other child. Everybody's loved the maximum. And if you're in the 100% maximum love category, then you don't have to deal with the arguments about, well, you like him more, and you love her more, and you think she's better. But no, we love you all the same, and we treat you all the same, and this is how it works out. And that sort of is a very good way to sort of keep in mind for your kids that you you don't have favorites. You know, I had an aunt once who used to say that she used to call any one of her children her favorite child, and then they all realized that she was calling them all her favorite, and they realized, oh, we're all her favorite child. So I just figured, well, there is this 100% maximum love concept, and I thought that was an easy way to understand it.
Well, with your tenets, your five common sense musts, can they easily apply to the single parent home?
Yes. You know, I think what happens, what I've seen in single parents, there are a couple of interesting things that I've noticed over time. First, many single parents think that they're operating at a handicap because they're single parents. And as a result, they think they need to punch the clock more, they need to be more dedicated to their children, or they can't take time to themselves. And I think that that creates an imbalance in the relationship with the child, meaning we are each the definition of the parent that we are. So whether we're a single parent or a married couple or, you know, a commune raising a child, we are the people who are going to take this responsibility, and we are the people who have our child's best interest in mind. There are very few people in our lives who care as much or more about us than our parents. And by caring about our children and, demonstrating that to them, I think that we define ourselves as the parent, as the mom. So single mom, single dad, I think I can relate to understanding a single dad more. And what's interesting for me is that a lot of my friends who have, started in marriages and had children and then got divorced, they weren't really that participatory in their relationship with their children while they were married. But once they got divorced, they were sort of fed into this 50% custody thing because they all wanted the custody, but they had to learn how to have a real relationship with their children. So divorce has been a very positive thing, I think, in lots of relationships because it shows the children who each of their parents are. And it's a very natural sort of evolution in a relationship that wasn't working out to be able to maintain your relationship with your children and they'll sort it out. Like, as we've discussed, kids are very, very smart. And, they love their dad for X, Y, and Z, and they love their mom for X, Y, and Z, or A, B, and C. And what will happen is sometimes they'll still know how to pit you against each other.
Right, but at least, exactly.
You'll have your relationship with your children, and your spouse will have their relationship with the child. And it's, it is harder. I think that to raise a child by yourself is obviously harder because I think it takes confidence.
Right.
And I think I got a lot of my confidence from my teammate, but who in this case was my wife. But a teammate can be your best girlfriend or your community or whoever it is with whom you can counsel about how you believe you should be raising your children. If you don't see it as a disadvantage, it won't be a disadvantage.
When you think about parents and maybe taking the wrong road, I wanted to have you respond to, often you will hear parents say how they want to be friends with their children, and being friends with their children negates some other things. What's your position on that?
I don't think it's my job to be my child's friend. I think it's my job to have my child back and to teach my child, how to judge whether their friends are the right people. But we have friends who used to allow their children to drink underage at their house because they're right. But that was, to me, a sort of breaking of the rule. And the rule is, I'm your parent, and these are my expectations. And I don't want you to drink underage no matter where you are. So I'm not going to assume that for you to be popular, you need to be a drinker. For you to be popular, you don't need to drink. You can be the designated driver. You can see that drinking gets people killed when they drive. You can see that it gets them sick when they go to parties. You know, again, setting an example, Joanne and I do not drink very much. You know, we'll have wine or something with dinner, but I never felt it was important for me to loosen my rules so that my children could be more popular or so that they would be more socially acceptable to a group of people who I didn't want them to be socially acceptable to.
In the first place.
If cool kids were drinking, then they didn't necessarily need to be cool kids. And that was what their parents thought about it. And, you know, we've been in carpools with parents who you pick your kid up at 4:30 or 5 and you're taking them home, and some parent says, well, I'd like you to have sliced vegetables in the car so when you pick them up, they can eat something. And it's like, we're taking them home. why would we give them food in the car? And, you know, so there are sometimes sort of crazy parents who sort of bubble up around you. And you have to stay true to your family and your values. And we used to say, that's not how we do it in our family. Like, your friends may do X, Y, and Z, but that's not how we do it in our family. And we created a real family consciousness about, these are the rules around here, this is how we work them, and this is how it's going to be. When you have your own family, you can do whatever you want. And that was, you know, the sort of the residue of what I believe has been a very solid, unifying concept for our children, both in their relationships with each other and their relationships with us. They're far more connected to each other now because they're all grown, except for the little sister who's in college.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they're communicating all the time, and it's largely because they get to make their own rules.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, their families, their communities, and other interested folks. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with Richard Greenberg. Richard, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to get your feel on just, do you feel like in this competitive, technologically advanced world, do you think kids are growing up too fast? Is there too much pressure to be an adult and their childhood is being, you know, abbreviated?
What a great question. I think that I think it's up to us as parents to allow them to be children, to allow them to be afraid of things, to allow them to ask us questions about things. There are some things we can shield them from, and there are some things we can't shield them from. They will, learn things in school, and my parents always felt that it was important for them to be a step ahead of whatever my friends were going to tell me, or at least to have me have enough confidence to come back to them and say, is this true?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think kids want to feel safe. I think they want to know that their mom and dad or whatever their family structure is care about each other,
mm-hmm.
and that their home is a safe place. And, you know, the world is pretty scary out there these days, and it's important for them to understand that when they get home, they, you know, nobody's going to attack them. They're not going to get in trouble. They're going to be spoken to with respect, and they're going to be asked what they're in the middle of. And I think that they don't have to grow up, and it's okay to let them. You know, there are a lot of stories about girls who play with dolls and who want to continue to play with dolls until they're 11 or 12. But at around 8 or 9,
mm-hmm.
their friends are like, you know, way past that. You know, like, oh, God, I can't believe you play with dolls.
Mm-hmm.
But Joanna was one of those girls who played with dolls until she was 13 or 14, and, you know, that was just something that was, you know, her parents never made a judgment about it. Nobody said, hey, you really need to grow up. Like, you can't believe you're still playing with dolls.
Right.
And so from the parents' point of view, we never forced them to have to deal with anything greater than we thought was reasonable. In terms of responsibility, of course, it was like, if you're at the park, you know, we want to know when you're coming home and, you know, what your movements are going to be. And there's a lot of technology now that parents can use to keep
yes.
track of their kids. And the kids, you know, with cell phones are always communicating But that was one of the, you know, rules about having a cell phone. If you have a cell phone, then you need to call me every time you leave somewhere and every time you get to the next place. And, you know, we also tested, you know, we checked with other parents. If they were going to have a sleepover, then we talked to those parents. We made sure what that sleepover was going to be. We made sure it was two kids and not three kids, because three is a bad number. And, you know, all those sorts of things. So I think our society would like our kids to be growing up really fast. I think song lyrics are a little pushing the edge. I think clothing is definitely pushing the edge. You know, I think of Kylie Jenner, or whatever, Kendall Jenner. Here's a girl who we've watched go from age 13, where it was like talking about her being a model, to now her modeling Cher clothes and being 18, and woohoo, you know. I prefer to believe that we can keep our children from becoming Kardashians by setting the example at home that is not Kardashian. But isn't also critical of everybody in the world. It's like, that's just the way they do it in their family. And again, that came back to us. This is how we do it in our family. And that becomes a great defense for a child when somebody says to them, well, why don't you bend and bang, you know, your parents won't let you ride a skateboard. That's like, this is just not how we do it
this
in my family.
Exactly.
And that becomes a very reasonable thing for them to be able to say to somebody who's being aggressive with them.
Well, you say in your book, more discipline than disciplining. What does that mean? Would you share that? I like that.
Well, it really comes down to the fact that, you know, a lot of people think being a parent requires that you discipline your children all the time, and you tell them this, and you tell them that, and you tell them this. But the bottom line for me is that it was about my having the discipline to not get upset when they were getting me angry, to follow the rules that I wanted them to follow. You know, if you have to cross the street at a crosswalk, if you're trying to teach your child to cross at a crosswalk, you have to cross at a crosswalk. You can't jaywalk. You know, we're back to do as I say, not as I do.
Right.
You can't jaywalk and then tell your child not to jaywalk. You have to walk to the crosswalk and walk across the street. And in that way, it requires us as parents to have that discipline so that we are showing them exactly what we expect of them. And sometimes it's just not fun. You know, I mean, I was a blood donor. I mean, it's not that this wasn't fun, but I ended up taking my kids with me when I would go give blood because I wanted them to see the process so that they would see that daddy was going to do something that hurt, but it was for a good cause. And, you know, I coached their sports for a long time. I coached various sports, and you know, that was like getting up at 7 in the morning to go coach a soccer game. I refereed. You know, these are all things I had to do because I wanted to show them that this is what, you know, how you stay involved, and this is what life is being involved in the process. And so some people don't want to do that. They want to sit on the couch, they want to drink beer, they want to watch television. And I totally get that. But that means that your child's going to grow up to want to sit on the couch, drink beer, and watch television.
That's right. That's exactly what it means. And as we look at emulating, I think another issue is just setting realistic expectations.
Yes.
You would agree?
Oh, I agree completely, because you can't, you know, let's talk about grades. Let's talk about parents who want those kids to get straight A's and measure it all by their grades. And I happen to be one of those kids. You know, my parents were really focused on academics, and I was not an academic learner. And, you know, I probably was ADD. I mean, there are probably 50 labels for what I was. But when I was a kid, all it was underachiever, class clown. And those two labels were bad enough. You know, I mean, it wasn't like there was a diagnosis, but I didn't learn the way other people learned. And, you know, my parents didn't necessarily tune into that. What they tuned into was, what were my letter grades?
Right.
And that was a cause of acrimony in my house and my childhood that made my home not a place that I was always happy to walk in the door. And, you know, look, you can be happy to walk in the door and know you have responsibility, which is how our children were. I mean, I don't think they were ever afraid to come home and face us. But, you know, the bottom line for me was I always felt that I was underachieving for them, and yet I wasn't, I was trying. And that was what was frustrating about it for me. And then we ended up having a child who was you know, the exact duplicate experience that I had, which was he would study and study. There would be a tutor. He would work with the tutor. He'd go in and take a test and fail. And I had that same experience, and I didn't realize it until he came home in tears at age 16 and said, I studied as hard as I could. I went and I took the test. I just couldn't get it right. And it was like, I remember being that kid. And so I had to cut him some slack. You know, we had to say to him, Kobe, do your best. We're going to do what we can to help you with your academics. And we took him to an educational, testing person, and that person told us he has an 11-minute attention span. Mm-hmm. And so we dealt with his attention span issues, and he started doing very well. But you have to listen inside your child, not just about what you want them to become as a parent,
exactly,
but what they are tending to become on their own. Mm-hmm. There's a very important part of them that has its own path. And I've seen a lot of parents, I have friends who went to medical school, and they became emergency room doctors. And then they said, why am I a doctor? They didn't even know why they'd become doctors, because their parents
had Right, right. How do we cultivate? I mean, you've raised four kids successfully. Yes. How does one cultivate self-confidence in children? Because that's a basic tenet. They've got to feel like I can. I feel good. You know, they've got that I can do this. From your perspective, how does one cultivate this self-confidence that's so much needed in children without doing it? Hey, listen, without doing it for them.
Well, first off, you can't do it for them.
Right,
you
know?
They know it's fake when it's fake, and they know it's real when it's real. So, you know, their self-confidence comes from your respecting them and their proper performance as much as it comes from their own sort of successes in the outside world with other people. And, you know, as a result, the confidence that they gain is largely about what they've learned about who they are. And I think that if you give them that moral backbone and you build that emotional scaffold inside of them, then they become self-confident because they're able to, you know, look through things and have a perspective that we as their parents have given them. When they go out in the world and they see kids behave like jerks, that to some degree is very sort of self-satisfying. It's very, it builds your ego to see somebody who's not quite as smart as you are behaving in a dumb way. And I have this expression in the book that is, rules are the arms with which our children can embrace themselves. Like, when they follow the rules, when they know they're a good kid, then they feel good about themselves. And that's the way that they build their self-confidence, is that they understand that they are following the rules and they're a good person. And that brings me back to that, how do parents evaluate their children? Do they evaluate them by their grades, or do they evaluate them by the content of their character? And I would prefer that we build children who have great character than children who get all A's. And that's really bottom line from my point of view.
As we talk about self-confidence, in the development of self-confidence, failure is a part of growing and learning. And so from your perspective, what role, what value does failure provide for these kids that are growing and maturing and developing?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that is one of my pet peeves about parents who don't think they should say no is that life is full of no. Life is full of failure, as you just put it, that of opportunities that don't happen or things that don't go your way. And I think that the measure of success in a person is learning how to deal with that no and learning how to overcome it and how to continue to make yourself happy as you move forward, even though something didn't go the way you wanted it to go. Mm-hmm. So the value of teaching your child to deal with adversity, the value of teaching them how to get over a painful situation or a friend who betrayed them or a grade they wanted and tried really hard to get and that they didn't get, but that they might see as a failure, is to say to them, this is a lesson, and this is a very good lesson, and how we deal with this is what we're really made of, not that it happened. Don't measure yourself by the failure. Measure yourself by the way you recover from that failure. And, you know, those are sort of, you know, fortune cookie kinds of logic, but the bottom line is it makes sense to me, and that to me is the value of failure. So that, you know, nobody is perfect and nobody does it right, including parents. And so we all have to assume that there will be a certain amount of failure in our lives, but if you keep your eye on the ball and it's off in the distance, then it's easier to maintain sort of the focus of where you're going in the immediate.
Mm-hmm. We touched on this a little earlier, but I wanted to ask you to elaborate in these last few minutes of the program, and that is respect. I mean, I know that's a part. Why is respect so important? What is the significance of respect?
Well, I think that if your children aren't respectful, they're not going to get very far in the world. You know, so again, if the title of the book is Raising Children That Other People Like to Be Around, then part of what people like to be around is somebody who's respectful, who's kind, who holds a door, who says, yes, thank you, yes, you know, please. And respect isn't something that you can demand. You know, we've all learned that over time, that people either respect you or they don't. You may be their boss, but they don't have to respect you if you don't do a good job or you don't care about how well they're doing. So as parents, I think it's crucial, and this comes back to the issue you asked me about, which is confidence. You know, having that confidence and being a confident parent means you have to respect yourself. You have to respect your own ability to make decisions. You have to respect that you can do a good enough job, that you have the right to expect your child to speak with you properly and to talk to other people with, you know, respect. That is all stuff that you are allowed to believe in, because when you believe it, then your children will believe it. And if you go out into the world and you model respect for them, and they see that respect comes back to you for it, then that's how they become respectful people.
Okay.
And, you know, my kids are working in the business that I was in for years, and they inevitably come on upon people who say to them, oh, are you Richard's son? And they'll say, yeah, and they'll go, oh, your dad was a really good guy, and he really dealt with me fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, when they hear that, they not only have pride about it, but they recognize the value in their own behavior of dealing with people fairly and being a nice guy. So respect has to do with what the parent feels as they're going into the game. If you don't respect yourself, and I'll put into that that you drink a lot or you don't come home in time or you eat sloppily, you never say thank you to your wife, your husband, you have a bad relationship in the house, then that's what you're going to model for your child in terms of how they think things are supposed to be. And so that respect issue comes from how we as parents feel about ourselves and how we treat the people in the world around us.
Okay. We have 2 minutes. I still have 1,000 questions for you. But first of all, we've been talking about your book. Where do we get your book? How does one access your book?
Okay.
Richard Greenberg, Raising Children Other People Would Like to Be Around.
Right. So if you go to Amazon.com and you just search Raising Children That, usually it'll autofill the rest of the book. So it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. I have a blog called CommonSenseDad.com. In fact, I'm Common Sense Dad in all media. I'm on Facebook as Common Sense Dad. I am on Twitter as Common Sense Dad. I'm on Instagram as
great.
Common Sense Dad. I'm on Pinterest, but I don't find many pictures that I think are particularly interesting. But I'm Common Sense Dad. So if you just Google Common Sense Dad, it should take you to any number of places where you could buy the book.
Okay.
And those are the best places.
Okay. One quick question. What is the value, and you talk about this, but you have 30 seconds to respond. What is the value of rituals and routines? Because you talk about that in your book.
I think it gives your kids a root. It gives them something to count on. When I turned 18 years old, my parents gave me a watch. Actually, I'm sorry. When I turned 21, my parents gave me a watch. And we started giving our kids a watch for their 21st birthday. It doesn't have to be fancy.
Mm-hmm.
It just has to be a marker of the time, no pun intended. And in that, they began to understand that our family, again, our family does things this way. We get a watch when we're 21 years old. When they were 18, I wrote them a note. I wrote each of them a note about their 18. They're now 18 years old. What do they think? You know, what do I think is going to happen for them in their lives, and what do I think they need to be careful about?
We are out of time, and I want to really extend to you a sincere appreciation. To my listening audience, that's it. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.